And we're saying good morning to Don Sutherland. How are you, Don?
G'day, Annie. It's great to be back with you, and hello to all of your listeners.
And it was a perfect segue, as Humphrey McQueen would say, to talk about the IR bill, because Kevin was on to it as well.
Well, Kevin has a certain cut through that maybe I don't have, and he sums things up rather sharply. But I think it is worth talking about some of the big issues around that are circulating around this massive struggle, but you know, that's happening in various forms around the level of wages and the character of working conditions.
Yeah.
And what the Secure Jobs, Better Wages bill has done is bring all of that to the fore. So there's almost, and people, I think, are getting a little bit tired and somewhat alienated from it all. All of this huge public debate, but mainly about amongst the commentariat, that's what's visible anyway. Quite less visible is, of course, that the unions are mobilising cohorts of their members to persuade at least one senator to support the changes that the new government has brought forward. So there is a real struggle going out there, which is about the ideas around wages, and then in various places there are real struggles about the material values of the value of wages. But of course, they are entirely restricted by the current rules, the so-called broken rules of the current Fair Work Act.
All right, tell us about this. What do you mean?
Well, I think the first thing is that this moment is of great significance. This battle that is focused on the Parliament is actually of tremendous significance for workers generally. And it's one that if we win, then there will be a mixture of very important changes and some that are not so important and will not deliver much, in my view. But nevertheless, the winning lays the foundation for experience for a struggle to get what is really needed on top of the some of the positive things. What the Act has done is actually it has introduced some things which I think deserve support and praise, and particularly they relate to gender inequality and other issues that are of significant, great significance to working women and their families. And so you get things like changes in the objects of the Act to include focus on gender and the specific needs of women workers. Those things are really important, and if adopted, they will be a breakthrough. The interesting thing is that those positive things, there is little to no controversy about those significant positive things.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking about the battle. Tell us about the battle lines, because we know that the boss class is not interested in fairness, and it's not interested in equity, and it's not interested in any of the things that the majority are actually interested in. They are interested in power and profit. So tell us what their battle lines are.
Yeah, well, the changes that are proposed that probably mean a minimal shift in power for workers are the ones that where there is the extreme controversy and opposition from the employers, and even they're minimal changes. So when you, and they're all around the issue of bargaining. The fundamental question with them is that They introduce changes that are mainly about promoting and enabling consensus and arbitration as a way of getting wages moving again, versus the use of workers being able to democratically use industrial action. That's the first thing. And in fact, associated with that, in our union movement, there is sort of a coyness and a defensiveness about industrial action. So at times, the arguments in favour of these minimal changes in regards to bargaining say, well, you know, they don't change industrial action very much at all, which is true. They don't. There is nothing really happening to enable workers to exercise their power more effectively on a legal basis using industrial action.
In fact, you'd have to say that in some respects, isn't it true that it's enshrining a notion that each time there is protected action, that the union has to do it every renew it every 3 months?
At the present moment, it's 1 month. So yes, you've hit upon one of the specifics in the changes that give the impression of being significant, when really they're not. They're not damaging to workers, but there's no significant step forward in terms of their right to exercise their power to withdraw labour.
Yeah, but it does tie. It does tie the unions up. In bureaucracy.
The way it's tied up is through the protected action ballot, as it currently exists.
Yes, exactly. That's the problem.
If a ballot is approved by a majority of the workers, and there's all sorts of red tape in there that unions just have not been able to remove, then the entitlement to take industrial action lasts for a month.
Yeah.
They have to take the action within a month. The change pushes it out to 3 months, and that's for single enterprise agreements, the common single enterprise agreement only. So all the process of getting a protected action ballot won, all of the red tape that unions have to deal with there, that's all intact. That does not change.
Right. Okay. All they've done is moved the goalposts a little bit.
Yeah, they've just moved it to 3 months. And they say in the explanatory memorandum that the purpose of that change is to enable more consensus building. Now, of course...
Tell that to Switzer.
Pardon?
Tell that to Switzer.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, the second thing it does, there is one other quite useful change, is that the employer, this is not an enhancement, well, it's the obverse, if you like, of a removal of an employer right to cancel an agreement during bargaining if the agreement has expired, which is the thing that Qantas have done and others. So that option for the employer is removed, basically. And so
that means
that there is, you know, that particular power that employers have had as a statutory power will not be there for them in single agreement bargaining. That's not unimportant, but it's not a positive enhancement of workers' powers, which are entirely constricted and therefore still against the International Labour Organization standards on workers' rights regarding industrial action. There is nothing of significance in there. And in fact, in the new multi-employer bargaining stream and the changes to the established, the existing multi-employer bargaining stream, the notice of industrial action has to be 120 hours. In other words, if the workers in those streams, the amended and the new ones, if they are able to take protected and have a protected action ballot, and if they win, they are then in a protected action period, and that does go out to 3 months. But if they choose to take action, they've got to give the employer this 120 hours notice.
Which is about, it's almost a week, right?
120 hours, well, it's going to vary according to, that's...
Rule of thumb, it's not quite precise.
Rule of thumb, yes, exactly. So, and its purpose is to assist the employer to deal with the problem.
Yeah, yeah, so that they can get other, well, we're not allowed to use that SCAB word, are we?
It's not to enhance the power of the workers.
Mm.
Now, so we come to the really big thematic question. Will the changes in bargaining that are being brought forward, and there are some that we haven't discussed so far, will they actually get wages moving again? Now, we don't really know. That may be, that is their intention as put forward by the government. But what does that mean in any case? You could get wages rising higher than they are, because they have been, you know, arguably in some sectors and for some pockets of the workforce, they have been increasing because of the way the labour market moves. That happens, you know, year in, year out. But you get them moving higher, but still not get them above the rate of inflation. And that's what actually happened with that quite significant annual wage review decision earlier this year. It was a significant increase, but after tax, it was still below inflation, and so there was no gain for workers in relative to prices.
It's interesting because the whole issue of wages, which is, you know, imperative for people living within the capitalist model, it's almost like, you know, because it's as if the profits are incredibly high, but they are pushing to screw the workers even more because capitalism requires continuous growth. They can't do continuous growth because we live in a finite environment. And so therefore they have to squeeze more out of the production line, right? That's how it works.
Well, there's two points there. Firstly, it is generally true that capitalism requires continuous growth, except for when it needs a recession to clean out its dead capital. And they need to do that in order to make the system more efficient again. That is, as over a period of time, the fixed capital becomes less and less efficient, and it therefore can retard profitability. And therefore, it needs to be cleared out. And that's one of the things that recessions or downturns do. But, of course, what goes with that is an increase in the intensity of hardship for the majority of workers. But they don't care about that. They do care about cleaning out dead capital. And just by the by, one of the features of the economy at the moment is the number of companies that you could call zombie companies. Are not even making enough profit, even though profits are going up really high, they're skyrocketing. There's a lot of companies not making enough profit to even pay off their interest on the borrowings they've made, and they're called zombie companies. So what capitalism wants is at some spirit, a sort of a down growth period that expels that dead, inefficient capital, so that what remains becomes more efficient at making profit.
I suppose what I'm really getting at is that we're focusing on wages, but when in actual fact we need the systems change.
Anyone who thinks this is all about wages is naive. This is really all about profits. And I might say profitability. Now, profitability, you can have really skyrocketing profits. And at the same time, you can have problems sometimes spreading across, generally across the economy, with profitability. And profitability is a different sort of beast that is rarely talked about in any common sense sort of way. To put it in really plain language, profitability is total profits divided by the value of fixed capital, essentially productive buildings, machinery and equipment, plus the value of wages. So you do that arithmetic, and at certain times profitability is rising, but it doesn't do that consistently, and it doesn't do that for more than, say, you know, it varies 7 to 10 years. Mm. When it starts going down, you see, when the Reserve Bank governor has those big, you know, wonderful dinners with employers, every employer in the room is listening to the governor and saying, what's this going to do to my profitability? So when the governor a couple of years ago was calling for them to pay higher wages, every one of them say, oh, yeah, everyone in the room is saying, oh, not me, but everyone else should do that, yes. because the profitability is what really obsesses them, and they pay a great deal of attention to it, and they pay a great deal of attention to making sure that it is not discussed in any of these, if you like, big public debates about the relationships between the working class and the employing class.
Well, you know, well, with profitability flatlining, as it were, which would be a natural progression, I presume, 7 to 10 years.
The evidence is that's roughly what's happening in Australia, that we're entering it, maybe more than entering, we may be further into it than we think, a downturn in profitability. And that means that employers want to hyper-exploit, to raise the rate of exploitation, and the latest data shows the rate of exploitation really going crazy, really bad for workers, especially in the mining industry. In the mining industry at the moment, the rate of exploitation is about 5 times higher than across the economy as a whole.
Wow.
Now, that puts what is commonly superficially talked about as the high wages in mining into much better context. And so if the employer, the mining industry that wants to carve out their situation and say it's special and all that sort of stuff, it sure is. They are exploiting the workforce in a really serious way, and it has the effect of de-unifying the working class, because workers who are not on such high nominal wages have no time for workers in the mining industry who are really having it ripped out of them at the present time.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? We have to finish up soon, so...
The final, I guess the other sort of thing is how do you get wages moving again from a worker's point of view? And the big question is going to be not just these changes, but the annual wage review. So the annual wage review starts officially in about, 3 weeks, something like that. Mm. And we go into that cycle. What flows from that, what should the ACTU claim be? And what should the government's claim be? Now, on the latter, when you listen to Bill Shorten on ABC Radio National on Wednesday morning, he said wages have to be got moving. But then he defined it a bit. He said moderate and reasonable. Now, moderate and reasonable, mm-hmm. What does that really mean?
Yeah, that's right. That's a great legal statement, isn't it? Not.
Now, will Burke say the same thing? The onus is on the union movement in the first instance to get a massive discussion going. I mean, the union movement is now great at political lobbying, and we're right into it with Lambie and Pocock at the moment. Mm. Yeah, we really are good at that now. Can we apply those methods to mobilising beyond union members to potential union members to get them talking about what our claim should be? Should it be just a keep up with inflation claim or a catch up claim? If it's a catch up claim, it must be around 7% or higher. If it's just a maintenance claim, then it means we don't catch up to what we've lost in the last X number of years. These are the sort of questions that we should get workers talking about. And that way, we can build a process where by the middle of next year, we've got another big increase. And we're fighting for an increase that is above the cost of living increases that workers are trying to deal with at the present time. Now, that, finally, that means confrontation. It does mean confrontation. And the consensus and arbitration framework of the changes that are being put forward that give more power to commissioners than it does to workers, with a couple of important exceptions, that must be challenged, because it will not be enough to win to get wages moving again using the annual wage review.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much for that analysis, Don. Very interesting indeed.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you all again, and I hope we have one more occasion before Christmas so that I can wish everybody in a proper way the compliments of the season, and we look forward to catching up again.
All right. Well, we'll make that a date.